Thank you very much and welcome to this conference call on the coronavirus and the prospect for finding a vaccine. My name is Jacob Eckholt Christensen, and I'm heading the global macro analysis here at Danske Bank. With me today is Bjarne Breinholt Thomsen, our senior equity strategist. Before introducing our speaker of today, we note that this call is subject to Danske Bank's research disclaimers and disclosures, and we refer the audience to the disclaimer that will be available at the end of the call and on our research website at www.research.danskebank.com. Now, let us turn to our speaker today, Allan Random Thomsen. Allan is a professor in virology at Copenhagen University with special focus on the immune defense system against viral infections and the impact of immune response on the course of viral infections. Hence, we think he is extremely well-placed to talk to us about the coronavirus that for the past 6 months have turned our lives, the economies, and the global order upside down as we have never seen before. Now I want to just give the word to Bjarne on the format of today's call.
Thanks, Jacob. I also would like to say a warm welcome to all our listeners today. And the way we're going to do the call today is that first, Allan will give his introductory remarks where he will touch on two major issues. The first issue is what have we learned after 6 months? What do we know about the coronavirus and what has surprised him the most? And hopefully he can shed some light on all the myths and uncertainties about the virus, such as whether it's correct that you can get infected twice, etc. The second part, also very interesting to hear, the prospect of finding a vaccine, how close are we really? What are the key obstacles in making a vaccine available to the population if you find a vaccine? And how many need to have the vaccine in order to reduce the risk of deaths from around the world? After Allan's introductory remarks, we will open the line for a Q&A session. Of course, questions for Allan, but also Jacob and me will be open for questions on how we see the effects on the economy and the equity markets, both from the virus in the near term and if we find a vaccine here. So, without much further ado, I think we should let the word to Allan. So, Allan, welcome. The floor is yours.
Yes, thank you. And I will jump right in and start with the questions that you sent me. So I don't know if the clients have seen the questions or I should repeat those first.
No, they haven't seen the questions. So just give you your remarks along the lines
yes.
that we suggested.
Okay. So one of the questions was, what are the most important things we've learned and has something surprised you? And I think one of the things we learned, but I guess particularly here in the Western world, is that this disease is much more complex than merely a severe flu virus. I think a lot of people, when we heard the reports from China, thought of it mostly as a severe flu virus and that it should be handled in the same way. And that has turned out not to be correct. And that is actually one of the things that has surprised me is how complex this disease is. I mean, there are a spectrum of symptoms from this disease that can appear. There are some people that are infected that have virtually no symptoms. Then there are people with a mild upper respiratory tract infection. Then there are people that get a lower respiratory tract infection of pneumonia, and that pneumonia can become really severe. And then finally, we have the worst stage, that is a multi-organ disease where a lot of critical organs are affected, and that may eventually kill you because of lack of essential functions like, for example, kidney failure, embolisms in your vessels, etc. So it it has surprised me how complex this is, and I think that's also the impression of most of the clinicians, because I must admit I'm not a clinician, I'm a laboratory person, so I just hear about this from my colleagues, but that is my impression. The question is this virus becoming less infectious or less lethal in the past 6 months or over the period of past 6 months? And I frankly cannot say, because we don't have the data to say that. I don't see any indications for that. I think that the reason why the death rates and the hospitalization rates is lower by now is, with regard to the death rate, it is that we have improved our ways to handle the infection at the hospitals. Referring to what I said earlier, a number of things have been found out concerning what are the vital aspects of this infection and what effects it exerts on the body. And that has improved the possibilities, very simply, of what we can call supportive care, something like improving the ability to provide oxygen, that people sometimes have to come into dialysis, that you should be aware of cardiovascular problems like emboli. And prevent that by giving the patients treatment for that. And then we have, of course, I shouldn't forget, we have remdesivir, which has now been approved as a critical antiviral drug, and we have glucocorticosteroids that has also been proven to improve the outcome of this infection. So overall, I think the reason why we don't see so many deaths, one of the reasons why we don't see so many deaths, is that we have become, or the clinicians have become, much better at coping with the essential symptoms of the disease. With regard to the hospitalization rate, that to a large extent reflects changes in the age groups that are primarily infected. For example, now here currently in Denmark, we see younger people becoming infected, and younger people are not as severely affected by this virus as older ones. So, as older ones. So, I mean, that in itself means that there are few people that are hospitalized. That may change if the current uprise in the infection spreads into the older part of the population, but it's not a major problem right now. Whether the virus has begun to mutate, well, that is for sure. It does mutate. This is an RNA virus, which means that it has an unstable genomic structure. And it does change all the time. And that is actually one of the qualities that virologists use to sort of fingerprint a virus, that there are these single-point mutations in the genome that will come out when you sequence the virus. But that does not mean that these mutations have a functional impact. A number of these are not translated into the protein level. They're just there. We can see them in our investigations, but it doesn't mean anything. And so at this point, there are not really any convincing evidence that the virus has begun to change. Having said that, the long-term prospects would be normally for a virus that has made a species jump is to become less lethal, less pathogenic than the original virus, but also to increase in infectivity. And that is something we may see in the long term, but we don't have any hard evidence at the moment that, that there's any sort of substantial changes at this level at the moment. So we cannot conclude what will happen with this virus in the long term, whether it will actually follow the sort of the normal rules for virus, and nor do we know if it does, what are the time frame for these changes. Another thing which has come up in the recent time, recent months, is that there are evidence that some people may become infected twice. And at least in one case, it's very well documented. That was a person from Hong Kong, where the virus was actually sequenced both at the first stage and the second stage. And it was clear that it was two different viruses. So the alternative explanation for being tested positive twice, namely that the virus persisted, is not relevant in this context. So it seems to be well documented that you can become infected twice. And now, what is the reason for this? There are basically two sort of major reasons. One could be that the virus has mutated so that the immune response raised against the first infection is no longer efficient against the second one. And the other is simply that the immunity induced by the first infection has waned over time. And of those two explanations, I really think that it is the latter that is the correct one. We know already from a number of studies on antibody levels in people that have come through the infection that particularly in those with the most moderate or less severe disease, the antibody levels decline rather quickly. And we also know from the classical coronaviruses that causes sort of cold-like symptoms that the antibody response following a superficial mucosal infection doesn't induce a good and long-lasting immunity. So in my opinion, the most likely explanation is that those people that have been tested positive and for sure tested positive twice are that the immunity that have been induced is waning. Does that mean that one become rapidly susceptible to the infection? Well, you may become susceptible to become infected, but not necessarily to get a more severe disease. It is notable that for many of the stories of these people that have been infected twice, that the second time round is much less severe in its symptoms than the first time, indicating that there is a partial immunity, but the immunity, so it's sufficient to avoid severe disease, but it is not sufficient, as I interpreted, that it prevents a reinfection. And I mean, from the point of the single patient, the avoidance of severe disease is the most important. When it comes to what we call herd immunity, of course, the question of whether you can become reinfected and pass on the virus is very important. And we don't know if these persons that are infected the second time, to what extent they actually shed the virus. That is a very relevant question that it would be nice to know more about. Regarding the winter, the fall winter time, I would expect, and I think many virologists with me would expect, that once we move inside and the temperature falls, that would give the virus more possibilities of spreading between individuals. So I would predict that in the coming months we would see at least minor increases in number of infected people, which we will then try and knock down again, and therefore there will probably be a sort of a shift between periods with very low numbers of infected, and then periods with a higher, sometimes almost threatening numbers of infected people. So this is the what I would expect, and if this virus behaves like what is normally case for respiratory tract infection like this one. Whether there will have to be lockdowns in these secondary, tertiary, whatever waves is a very open question. I think many people hope and believe that it should be possible to keep the lockdowns more focused, more locally based. But of course, depending on the speed with which virus sort of resurges, that will define how extensive any lockdowns will have to be. So it's very, very difficult to say. But at least in Denmark, I don't expect to see a national lockdown in the near future as what we saw in March. I think we have become better at controlling the infection, and for that reason don't need that that kind of extensive general tools that we used in March. That was about the virus and the virus situation and how it will fluctuate in the near future. Then let me turn to the question of the vaccine. One of the questions is how many vaccine candidates have a real chance of becoming an effective vaccine. And I would say there are quite a number, including several of those that are actually sort of leading the race right now that have already entered into phase three trials. They are likely to be effective. Whether they will be the ultimate choice once we've been through a number of different vaccines, that is another question, but they would certainly, I believe, be able to give us some handle to control the infection. How fast an effective vaccine will be available globally is a very, very difficult question. I mean, I would think that in the Western world or the Nordic countries and EU, I very much hope that we will be able to vaccinate the first people in around summertime next year. The phase three trials are running. Several of these are likely to provide results by sort of end of this year or more likely beginning of next year. Then the results will have to be applied to the authorities for evaluation, and hopefully then we can have a preliminary acceptance of the vaccines. And what is good is that because there have been a lot of money invested in these vaccines, several of the companies have already started producing vaccines, expecting that they will be approved by the authorities. And that would mean that we're not starting from scratch when the approval actually comes around. Then there will already be a number of doses ready for shipment and for implementation of the vaccine program. So I think there are really good prospects of the vaccines. And I think I'm also been asked which candidates are the most promising. I would say that the one based on Oxford AstraZeneca is certainly one of my favorite candidates. Moderna is also a likely candidate. I've seen the phase two data from these, and they both look promising. Actually, the Russians have just published their first data on their vaccine. And they are also acceptable, I would say. The problem about what they have done is that they simply bypass the phase three in order to get the approval. But if you look at that data as a phase one, two kind of result, they look okay, which is actually not that surprising because the basic concept of their vaccine is the same as that of Oxford. So, I mean, it's promising. Whether we will ever get a Russian vaccine here in Europe, in EU or the Scandinavian countries is another very open question. I don't think so, but it is encouraging what they find. There's actually also at least one of the Chinese vaccines that look okay. I guess the main problem with these vaccines in order to get into the EU will be whether they can deliver sufficient hard data to prove that they don't have any adverse effects that would raise major concerns. And actually, that brings me to one of the next questions, that is that since the phase three trials will be shortened, will that have a risk for the patients? Yes, to some extent it will, because you may cut the phase three shorter and also have fewer people in there and look at these people for a shorter period of time, you may overlook some of the very rare adverse effects. But on the other hand, this is a balancing of how fast we want to have the vaccine in place versus the risk of having rare, and I'm talking about really rare adverse effects, because that is what you may miss when you cut these phase three trials short. When I will expect a global vaccine, that, as I mentioned, is quite an open question. I think there will be a lot of competition between the countries, and even though there are initiatives by the WHO trying to get a balanced distribution of the vaccines, I find it likely, at least, that the Western countries like EU and the US would probably have their share in the beginning, and only afterwards will there be substantial distribution to many of the other countries. Although, for example, a country like India, they are producing already by now millions of doses of the Oxford-based vaccine. So I guess at least part of those vaccines, the standard part, will be released in India. So that is also a possibility. How big a share of the population that needs a vaccine in order to make a difference is quite difficult to say. I mean, for ordinary herd immunity, which is a more absolute term, that is when we talk about a vaccine inducing an immunity which prevents an epidemic from establishing itself in the population. That is around basically 70% should be immune. And if the vaccine is not 100% efficient, then we would require probably 80-85% being vaccinated, I would think. But you don't need necessarily to have that high proportion of people vaccinated in order to have a substantial impact. I mean, if you choose to vaccinate the right groups, those at risk, frontline personnel, etc., you may have a substantial impact on the epidemic prior to having that larger part of the population vaccinated. I mean, the most important thing is to shield those that are most vulnerable. And you basically have two strategies for that. One is to vaccinate those that are contributing to the spread of the virus, assuming that the vaccine would not be as efficient in those patients that are at risk. Alternatively, you go right at it and vaccinate those at risk and accept that some of these people may not respond to the vaccine as efficiently as a fully healthy person. That is something which has to be evaluated very carefully. Will such a vaccine stay effective in the long term? Well, to a large extent, I think it will. I mean, even though the virus mutates, mutation in at least one of the most critical sites that would be affected and would affect the efficiency of vaccine, that a mutation, a substantial mutation at that site would also affect the ability of the virus to enter human cells. So it's not, in my mind, that likely that the virus would mutate heavily, say like what we see with flu virus. But of course, this is all predictions, and I mean, nature may prove me wrong in the long term. But I don't think it's a major problem. And anyhow, if we have seen one vaccine work, then we know how to make another one by simple molecular tools. So that should only be a setup, but not a final problem or a problem without any solution. So I guess more or less that I have answered all the questions that has been asked. So I leave the word to you.
Thank you very much, Alan. And I think we will open up the lines for questions right away, operator.
Absolutely. So ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. Alternatively, if you're joining the conference online, select the flag icon. If you change your mind, please press star followed by two or the flag icon once again. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. Now we have our first question from Thomas Powers from Danske Bank. Thomas, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just a couple of questions here. Just on the risk of reinfection, so patients being infected by COVID-19 twice, I'm just wondering, do you see any spillover from fading immunity to the vaccine front-runner candidates in regards to response duration? So, or would this maybe rather be reflected by mutation of the virus? So more like the influenza-like drifting of the virus, even though you mentioned it, doesn't mean that much.
That's a very relevant question, and it depends on what these sort of failures to protect reflects. If they reflect that the virus has mutated, then it has impact on the capacity of a vaccine to protect. This is not the interpretation I lean towards. I think what has happened is that there is waning of the immunity. And if that is the case, then I don't see that it is a major problem in the context of vaccines, because the way in which you immunize the persons with a vaccine is very, very different from what happens in the context of the natural infection. And we have previous situations where we have a natural infection that doesn't induce good immunity, but we have a very efficient vaccine, and that is the human papillomavirus, which is doesn't induce protective immunity through natural infection, but as you know, the HPV vaccine has proven very efficient and actually have provided a very long-standing protection. So, I mean, it all depends on whether the failures that we see reflect mutation, or it reflects a waning of immunity, whether there is an interplay with the capacity of a vaccine to work. As I said, I don't think that there is a problem.
Okay, great. And then just a second question, if I may. You mentioned being quite encouraged about the approach from Astra and Oxford, and also the messenger RNAs, in particular Moderna. So I'm just wondering, is this thought as a sort of a first in line response, or do you see these candidates even also potentially be part of a global vaccine program? I'm just thinking, at least for the primate data with the Astra candidate, it sort of was, in my world, sort of a mixed result on efficacy. And also, so you have sort of the new platform here with the RNA, especially maybe even going to see a logistic nightmare with, storing it at minus 70 degrees would be quite problematic in getting it into to every doctor's office. So any comments here?
Yeah, well, I've been working myself, or in my lab, we've been working ourselves with the ethno concept that is also the foundation of the Oxford and the Russian vaccine. And I would actually think that they will be rather efficient in humans. They both induce antibodies, and the Russian study is a little bit difficult to interpret in terms of magnitude, but they both induce good or detectable, that's how I should put it, detectable T-cell immunity. And that is always good for a vaccine to sort of activate both arms of the immune system. So I think they would be part of a global response. Whether we will find better vaccine, you know, further on, I cannot say, but certainly the adeno concept have been tested with success in the context of the Ebola virus infection. So I think that it would be a vaccine that would prevent severe disease. Whether it will prevent superficial infections of your respiratory tract, and whether it will also provide reduction of spreading of the virus, that is another question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Christine Cookson of Danske Bank. Christine, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So, Ellen, I'd like to ask you, we hear that mortality rates are much lower than we feared in spring, and the risk of lockdown has been reduced on that ground. But now we also starting to see these stories about the late and more long-term consequences of people not dying who get that from this disease. And it seems that this might be where the COVID-19 actually differ from a regular flu. To what extent is this something, these late and long-term consequences of catching the disease, something that politicians might need to react to with new lockdowns in order to safeguard the health system longer term?
Oh, that is a very good question. There is a tendency not to look too much into the long-term effects. At least that is my impression. It's not something we talk that much about in public, so I don't think that the politicians are too aware of that problem. But you're absolutely right. That is an important question. And the problem is also that a number of these people that have these long-term effects, they are sort of in the middle age group, people that would not they would not be susceptible to die from the disease, but they could have that, meaning that they are actually people in the most productive age, and if they are put out of function for just even for a longer time, that is something that should be looked into. The problem is, of course, we don't know for obvious reasons how long these long-term effects actually last. Are they actually lifelong, or will you recover from from this with time? I mean, I think the general impression is that many of these symptoms are related to sort of a kind of scarring of the lungs, and whether the lungs will recover from that scarring with time is a very open question that we cannot answer at this moment. I'm sorry to say.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Regis Bew from Lazard. Regis, please go ahead.
Yes, hello. I am wondering whether you have a view of the kind of people, candidates who tested the vaccine yet, because I'm wondering whether if we vaccinated the most sensitive people, those who can have a very strong and a very pathologic immune response, then the vaccine would trigger that pathologic immune response and would eventually kill them. So I'm wondering whether it will be easy to switch from the candidate population to an elderly population or a sick people population to deploy the vaccine.
I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but I think what you're asking is, would it be more advantageous to vaccinate sort of the young and healthy to prevent the virus from spreading from this part of the population to the more susceptible patients because the vaccine may not be as efficient in the susceptible population?
Yeah, that could be, yeah. My question is that isn't it dangerous to vaccinate the elderly ones that could be very sick from the vaccine?
Well, I don't think they would be very sick from the vaccine, actually. I think the problem normally when you're elderly is that your immune system is not as capable of responding to new stimuli as the immune system is when you're young. So often we see that vaccines are less efficient in the elderly. For example, if we take something like the flu vaccine, there is a poor response rate in the elderly population than in the younger population, and clearly that is a problem. You touch upon a very difficult question, actually, because I mean the worst case scenario is that if you get a partial immunity, would that actually increase the likelihood of having a severe disease rather than protect you? And that is something which is, I think, absolutely impossible to predict from any kind of animal experiments, because you cannot translate animal data into humans when it comes to something which is so much a balanced response that is required. So I guess I have to be very harsh and say that can only that information we can only get when we see and when we get the results partly from the phase 3 data, but of course also when we come to the phase 4, which is part of the rolling out of a vaccine program.
Yes. Okay. So they would need some time to understand how the vaccine works in the real world. That's what I mean. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, every time you introduce a new vaccine, you do make a kind of a gamble, because you cannot be sure that the that what you see in the human population is what you've seen in experimental animals, for example. And there have been some cases earlier in history where a vaccine had actually increased the severity of a disease. So this is something that the that those that are proving the vaccine are looking very much for signs of that happening when they evaluate the figures they get in from the clinical testing, and they look for special types of immune response which makes it more likely to see that effect that we're talking about. But of course, nobody can guarantee that this would not happen before we have empirical data to support this.
Yeah, and sorry, just another question. There was a kind of rumor or observation that the flu vaccine had increased the likelihood of getting the COVID. So it was then it was debated because it was maybe statistically not very significant and debatable. But do you have a view on that prospect?
Yeah, I think most people, including the WHO, advocate that in the coming season that those that are at risk for both flu and COVID-19, which is very overlapping population, that they do get vaccinated because the belief is that it would be worse to have both infections, one before the other, because that would impair your capacity, your lung capacity, and make it more difficult for you to cope with the next one. So I think the overall recommendation is to have the flu vaccine this winter for all those that are at risk.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that we can take maybe one or two questions more, given that it's so interesting. People can, of course, jump off if they don't have time, but just in the interest of getting as much of the insights from Alan, let's maybe take one or two more questions if there are those. Okay, it seems like we don't have more questions. In that case, I think we will wrap up this call. I think speaking on behalf of all of us, Alan, it's been extremely interesting to listen to your insights, and we are very, very grateful that you took the time to be on this call. For all listeners and other ones, we will send out a recording of the call afterwards, as well as some key takeaways in the notes. So stay tuned for that. And before we end the call, I will mention that this call is intended for information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to purchase or sell any financial instrument. Danske Bank accepts no liability for any loss arising from any use of the information on this call. The call is only suitable for professional investors and not suitable for retail investors. It is also not intended for persons outside the European Economic Area. This call may not be reproduced or distributed without prior consent. We refer to Danske Bank AS full disclaimer, which is available on our research site at www.research.danskebank.com. I think with those words, Bjarne and I will and Alan will say thank you to all the listeners. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.